the news, views, and music you love, KKFI, wherever you are.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Today, host David Bell speaks with Mr. Dion Sankar, the Chief Deputy Prosecutor for the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. This will begin David's new Justice series. Justice is a concept that is personal to each of us based on our own experiences and histories. In any society, the justice system represents an open forum in which these individual concepts collide daily. Our collective hope is that enough of a balance is reached to keep all participants committed to the system. David Bell asks Dion, the Chief Deputy Prosecutor for the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, to help us understand what justice means to him and how he pursues justice for victims, defendants, and other stakeholders. According to Theodore Roosevelt, justice is found not by being neutral between right and wrong, but by finding out the right and upholding it, wherever found, against the wrong. I cannot fail to also quote Shakespeare, "An earthly power doth show likest God's when mercy seasons justice." Stay tuned to hear the Jackson County Chief Deputy Prosecutor. We'll play our calendar at the midpoint of the hour. On Jaws of Justice, we examine how to find justice in our society. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. We've just finished our empathy series. And during that series, we spoke with a number of individuals about what empathy means, and particularly how we can be empathetic with a person when we do not have a shared experience with that person. And when I think about that series, I keep coming back to retired KCPD officer Kimberly Shaw Ellis's quote.
I think we all have something in common in that we all know what it feels like to be sad. We all know what it feels like to be scared. We all know what it feels like to be loved and to love. We all know what it feels like to be fearful and anxious and worried and concerned. We all know what it feels like. We all know those emotions. I don't have to know your journey to walk in your shoes to see that your souls are worn. Mine are too. And it doesn't mean that I've experienced the same experiences you've had, but I've experienced things that have caused me to know what it feels like to be fearful, that I know what it feels like to hurt or be lonely or be sad or to lose someone. I know those feelings, and I can relate to you that way because we're human. I can see you there because we're human. I can connect with you that way because we're human.
And, you know, certainly in one-on-one interactions, the concept of empathy and even its application appears somewhat obvious. But what happens when we add multiple people to the mix? What if I now have to make decisions about an event or an issue that impacts multiple people, each with different experiences and different expectations? How does empathy turn into action without losing the very reason why we are being empathetic in the first place? To answer this question, we'll be talking with a variety of people over the next few months about the concept of justice. Our first guest, and one whose insight I hope will set the stage for the rest of the discussions, is Dion Sankar. Dion is the Chief Deputy Prosecutor of Jackson County, Missouri. In terms of Dion's role at the prosecutor's office, in addition to being the second in command after elected prosecutor Gene Peters Baker, I've tried cases against him and I've negotiated with him to resolve cases, and I am honored that he has joined us here today. Dion, thank you for being here.
No worries. I'm happy to be here. I wish I had a better radio voice. That's the way I start off.
You sound great to me, Dion. So could you first give us a little bit of background about yourself?
Yeah. So I probably have what some people might think is a little bit of a unique path. I was not born in America. I was born in Guyana, which is a North Central South American country. It's a small country. My family has this really fascinating backstory that we love to tell in our home. It surrounds my mother and my father. They left Guyana when I was 5 years old. I've got an older brother who, when I was five, was just over 10 years old. And they left Guyana because my older brother, who is by far and away the smarter of the of the Sankar brothers and children. He was, by lack of a better term, drafted into a military school because of his ability and technical skill with math and science. And at the time, Guyana was underneath a president or a leader that was very into the military. And my parents, being the people they were very fearful that my brother would be pulled into some type of international conflict. And they may never see him again. And because of that risk, which to them was substantial at that point, they decided that the best thing to do was to leave their very established professional lives in Guyana and try to make a different path that they believe would be a safer one for their children, my brother and myself. So my dad was an architect. My mom, who is in banking, we had a beautiful home in Guyana. I've seen pictures of it. I've never been to it. They left on a whim. First, my brother and my father, and then I joined them with my mother some months later, and we moved to the Bronx, New York. It was kind of a lower class to very low middle class neighborhood, a mixed race neighborhood. And that became really my formative years there, was watching my parents, who came over to America with $35, really put everything and anything on the line to make sure that their two children had safety, opportunity, education. That was always their thing. And it really ingrained in me kind of a work ethic and really a sense of doing things for other people, even sometimes at the expense of yourself and what might make you happy. My mother, who is an extremely bright woman, she gave up on banking for a number of years and started working as a maid at hospitals, at nursing homes, in people's houses to just make ends meet. And my dad, who was an architect and was a really a successful one, stopped doing that to work security at Sears and Roebuck, where he really worked until he got into the latter part of his 60s. And it wasn't until then, the very end of his life, that he started moving back into more of a career with respect to architecture and using some of the technical skills that he had. So it was really fascinating to watch that. And it all came back around for my mother as well, who, after I graduated from college and went to law school, my brother graduated from college and went on to teaching, my mom went back to Hunter College in New York and got her degree here in Americas to match the one she had in Guyana. She ended her career working for Bank of America and retired from there. And now my parents are both retired. They're both tired and driving each other crazy in New York.
And so I know that at one point you were thinking about being a history teacher and a football coach. You played football in high school and then you played in college a little bit. But something happened during, I believe, a course that you were part of that changed your mind and changed the direction and brings you here today.
Yeah, so I had an academic advisor for my minor, which was in Judaic Studies at Fairfield University, named Dr. Ellen Umansky. And she just made just a profound impact on me. She helped me to become a better writer and a researcher when I was in college, because I was really fascinated in history, especially military history. World War II is always a fascinating period to me. And I worked with her on a project, and it was regarding the Holocaust. And she invited me to see a speaker, and it was really an amazing moment in my life, because I had a chance to see Morris Dees speak. And Morris Dees is a lawyer that many people credit with bankrupting the Ku Klux Klan. He brought a series of very clever, strategic, and smart civil litigation lawsuits against members of the Ku Klux Klan and really bankrupted their organization in the South. And to it, I think he risked a lot, his own personal safety, I'm sure his family's safety and the people around him. And I heard him speak, and I remember Dr. Umansky telling me after, you need to do this. You need to use your skills to help other people, and you should go to law school. And at the time, I never saw myself as a lawyer. I always thought, I'm a kid from the Bronx who played a sport that, you know, I was fortunate enough to use to get into schools. And frankly, I didn't see that for myself, but she saw something in me that really changed the course of my life. And because of her, I took the LSATs and ended up getting into a law school, and, you know, sort of promised her and that mother I mentioned that I would give it a shot and see what would happen. And here I am today, because those two women sort of saw something different for me than I even saw for myself.
And I know you worked at a firm in New York for a while doing plaintiff's medical malpractice. And one of the interesting things about that, when we were talking before, is that the partner there at the firm indicated that he or she wanted you to work on the defense side. Could you talk to me about that and what the reason behind that was?
Yeah, so I I mean, I've had a lot of fortunate people come into my life, and one of them was Harold Weissman, who was the dean and the senior partner at that firm at Weissman and Calderon. And I was hired there out of law school. The first thing that Harold told me was that every associate that's the person who joins a law firm, they're an employee of that law firm. And he said, every associate that comes in here, I won't let you work on a plaintiff's case. I won't let you bring a lawsuit on behalf of a person if you don't understand what it's like to be sued by another person and understand what it feels like to be in their shoes and evaluate the case and the circumstances that you're in from their perspective. I won't let you be on the other side. I won't let you wield the power of starting a lawsuit against someone else. And it really, I think, in a lot of ways, shaped my legal career, because I've always looked at things whenever I get a case or a circumstance that comes before me. I always try to look at it from both sides immediately without trying to form an opinion as to what I think is the thing to do or the outcome that we should seek. So I'm grateful that someone like Harold did that for me right off the bat. And it really showed me and helped me really understand how to litigate cases at a very young age as a lawyer.
And you eventually came to Kansas City. You worked at the McAllister firm as a plaintiff's lawyer. You also did some criminal work. And then I know you went to work from there at the AG's office, Attorney General's office, actually representing police officers that had gotten in trouble.
That's right. Yeah. So I started off at the McAllister firm when I first moved to Kansas City. And that firm had a portion of their book of business was to pursue cases against different governmental agencies, including police departments. Through that, I made some dear friends who were on the opposite sides of cases in which they were defending law enforcement officers that I was involved in suing. They, you know, mentioned to me that they had a position open and thought that I should apply and I might be good at it. And I was fortunate enough to get a position there. And I did work defending police officers and really trying to understand from their perspective the things that were important to them and how they viewed the world and how they viewed these incidents in which they were being challenged or allegations were being made against them.
And then from there, the AG's office, you then came to where you're at now at the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office.
That's right. Yeah. So my current boss, the elected prosecutor, I worked for her sister at the Attorney General's office. And while I was at the Attorney General's office, I met a person who has my position now, Paige Bellamy, who I look up to. He's now Judge Bellamy, and Gene Peters Baker. And they both discussed, and Gene specifically discussed with me, the idea of coming and joining her administration as a member of the executive staff and working on a number of different things, including diversion initiatives, use of force cases. They wanted someone that had the ability to litigate cases as well as administering and assisting in administration of the office, which is its own massive machine. And I remember telling them at the time that, you know, similar to what Harold told me all those years before, I need to be able to walk in the shoes of a prosecutor. So I wanted to take on my own litigation caseload so I could understand what it was like to be a prosecutor if I was ever going to be someone that managed them on a day-to-day basis and perhaps came in at times and said, hey, I think you should do this rather than what you're doing. I figured it was best I understand what it's really like to be them before doing that.
And so since then, and I know that it's been in the news, we're not going to talk about any specific cases, but you've now prosecuted police officers as well.
Yes, I've been involved in multiple prosecutions of police officers. I lead that use of force committee within the prosecutor's office, which is the designated group of prosecutors who evaluate use of force circumstances or police misconduct all across Jackson County.
And so when I first came to you about being a guest on the show, and I mentioned that I wanted to talk about justice, I know you told me that you actually went and kind of looked it up, like the term justice. And that's a great point, because I, you know, we all have a concept in our mind of what it might be, but you went to check to see what the expected definition is. And what did you come across that surprised you?
It was surprising to me because, you know, in our world, you know, we use the word justice and it usually means whatever the person saying it wants it to mean, right? They want it to be something that is meaningful to what they are asking a court or a jury to do. And I remember when I thought about it and, you know, you made the request for me to come on the show and I was excited to do it. I remember feeling like, you know, let me just look it up and see what the common person, if they get a question, what does justice mean? What would they say? And it's sort of interesting and fitting to me that it, what you see is words like impartial, fair, balanced. You don't hear things like vengeance, accountability, leniency. And that really was interesting to me, because when I think about that and I think about the work that I do, I think it's really fitting that when we hear as prosecutors the word, you know, you're here to be a minister of justice, you're here to do justice, it is really that you are here to be that balancing aspect on the scale, to work for the entire system and for all of the parties involved to make sure that fairness is given to everyone.
I know the term justice also brought to mind an author that is one of your favorites. And if you could talk briefly about that and that quote.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people that know me know I love history. I just mentioned that. The Civil War, Reconstruction, Jim Crow South, you know, really everything and anything in that time period up to the present is something that interests me. And W.E.B. Du Bois is one of my absolute favorites. He's written some astonishingly prescient books that are really specific and have just like an amazing way of detailing what life was like at the time that he was living and what he was studying, which was Black Americans and how their lives were impacted by society and the history of America. And in his work, The Souls of Black Folk, which is an amazing group of essays that he wrote just at the turn of the century, he wrote something that always sticks with me, and it stuck with me at the moment that I remember Gene offering me a job. The quote is, "It's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." And the reason why I thought about that quote at the time that Gene offered me that job and the honor of working for the people of Jackson County was really this idea of, you know, I'm going to be a Black man, and at times in this job, I'm going to have to make a recommendation to a court or to a jury that another Black man or someone that is poor, a white person or a Latino person, that they be sent to prison, forever changing the course of their lives, and knowing in that moment the impact that I'm going to have on perhaps their children, their loved ones, and knowing what the system has done to so many people, that is a difficult thought. And I remember thinking about it at the time and really being concerned that, you know, could I do it? You know, could this be something that I should do? Could this be something that is the right thing to do? And I think looking at it now, the idea of that two-ness is actually, it's been a strength to me, because I've always thought to myself, I want to have at the forefront of my mind whenever I'm considering a case or a circumstance for a defendant or a victim, I want to be able to weigh everything at the same time, all at once. To borrow the phrase from the now famous movie that's kind of floating around, because if I forget the humanity of any one of those players involved in it or the interest of the public in being safe, I'm going to miss something that's going to be important, and I'm going to cause some harm to someone because I'm not thinking about what is important to them. And oftentimes that means every one of those entities is not going to get everything that they want. But that goes back to kind of being a prosecutor. And, you know, David, when you reached out to me, there was another thing that struck me in the idea of two-ness is thinking about the 1930s decision in the U.S. Supreme Court case Berger. It's always a famous quote. Prosecutors always throw it around, but if I could, I want to just read it to you. And it states, "A prosecutor is a representative not of an ordinary party to a controversy, but of a sovereignty whose obligation to govern impartially is as compelling as its obligation to govern at all, and whose interest, therefore, in a criminal prosecution is not that it shall win a case, but that justice shall be done. As such, he is in a peculiar and very definite sense the servant of the law, the twofold aim of which is that the guilt shall not escape or the innocent suffer. He may prosecute with earnestness and vigor, indeed, he should do so, but while he may strike hard blows, he is not at liberty to strike foul ones. It is as much his duty to refrain from improper methods calculated to produce a wrongful conviction as it is to use every legitimate means to bring about a just one." And again, even there, you have this idea, this twofoldness within the system, this balance that's there. And I think that having that always be present for me, to think about myself in kind of two spaces at once, as either considering what I want to have happen for the victim and the defendant and the public safety, is important to me. And I think I've used the experiences I've had in my life of always sort of having to separate myself as being perhaps either someone that's Black, but not American Black, or, you know, being a young person in a room with more senior lawyers to try to work through how everyone's interests come to play in a given situation to figure out how best to address everyone.
But, you know, going back to the quote that you read from Souls of Black Folk, before that part that you read was, a world which yields him no true self-consciousness, which was what I focused on. And here's why. One thing I've always certainly admired about you in watching you work is, first of all, whatever decision you make is the wrong one to somebody, it seems like. I mean, just from watching from afar, it doesn't matter what the decision is, it's someone's going to be upset with you about it. And so as a result of that, you certainly would have to lean into your sense of right and wrong and who you are. And that quote to me suggests that, all right, if society is not going to impose that on you or certainly not going to give you an identity, that you would have to develop one from within, which actually sounds to be the healthiest way and the strongest way to do it, because however that developed within you, that's it, right? And it's strong and it's true because it came from you and your personal experiences.
I think that's right. And I mean, look, everybody's just a kid from somewhere, right? And I think that for me, I can't help but think that, you know, having the parents I had, watching them do the things they did, it really had more of an impact on me than I ever realized. You know, I think in their actions and in their words, they were teaching me that, you know, you have to live this life in a way that gives back to the people around you. You know, I'm somebody who, I'm very much an outgoing person. Most people know me as someone who's somewhat social. And I want to leave the people in my life in a better place, even if they're just there for a moment like a victim or a defendant. My hope is that my actions will reset and put things in a better perspective. And I think that comes directly from my parents and the life that they worked so hard to give us and my ability to kind of ferret through things and look at things. I think it's a direct result of them telling me by their own actions, this is what we think is the right thing to do.
Our guest today is Dion Sankar, Chief Deputy Prosecutor with Jackson County. We've been talking with Dion in the first half hour about how his life experiences serve as a foundation for what justice means to him on a personal level. In the second half hour, we will explore how Dion applies this personal concept of justice to his work as a prosecutor. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Support for KKFI comes from the You Spin Anywhere, a music extravaganza festival taking place on Friday, September 29th from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Lemonade Park in the West Bottoms. Performances by Jazz, Sabaneros, MGM, Lucid Flows, and Lou Rip, and more, with music also powered by you. For more information, go to Instagram/YouSpinSocialMusicApp.
Voices of Kansas City is a community conversation produced by the Kansas City Star. Fridays at noon, tune in to 90.1 FM to hear Kansas City Black business owners share their stories of struggle, commitment, success, and joy.
A new Kansas City Star project created in collaboration with Kansas City Gift, a nonprofit that supports growing Black-owned businesses, and KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Join us at noon on Fridays this fall for Voices of Kansas City.
Beginning Friday, September 22nd, right here on KKFI.
Here's the calendar for the week of September 25th. Legal Aid of Western Missouri can provide free civil legal services to low-income and vulnerable people who live in Jackson County, Missouri. Interested individuals can call 816-474-6750 to apply. 816-474-6750. To learn information about Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense meetings this week, you can go to momsdemandaction.org. All are welcome, mothers and others. Please check the calendar at moresquare.org for events you can attend. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That list is updated daily. Saturday, September 30th, no time listed, there's a DACA Renewal Clinic, an online event hosted by Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance and AGH Law with attorney Andres Hernandez. More information at Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, KSMODA, on Facebook. Items listed in this calendar can also be found on this episode's page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org, as well as on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. Please, take care of yourselves and others. Thanks for listening to Jaws of Justice. Let's now return to the program.
This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest today is Dion Sankar, Chief Deputy Prosecutor with Jackson County. After learning about the foundation for Dion's personal sense of justice in the first half hour, we will now be talking to Dion about how this personal concept manifests itself in his work as a prosecutor, where he must make daily decisions that impact a number of lives. So, Dion, really quick, going back to the first half hour, certainly your life experiences have permitted you to be empathetic, and you are empathetic to people in a variety of circumstances, primarily because of your own experiences, but also probably a skill you developed over time to where you can put yourself in the place of participants in the criminal justice system, for example. But I have to wonder, through all of that and being able to be in the position of others, at some point you have to come back to being you and making a decision, justice, fairness, impartiality, whatever you may call it. And I'm wondering, what do you lean into to do that?
You know, that's... It's a great question, and I wish I had a more clear, direct formula for it. There probably should be one in my head, but in reality, it is. I often look at the global problem of how did we get here? How did these people come into each other's lives and get to the spot that they were in? And try to put myself in the shoes of the choices that were made by each individual person, and thinking through what would help each one of them individually, and then what would help, you know, collectively in the situation. As far as myself goes, I think I always think about it when I have young prosecutors come to me and talk to me about one of their cases, and they describe the thing that happened as, you know, the worst possible thing. And oftentimes in our world, it's pretty horrific what occurs. And I try to tell them, I say, you know, whenever you're about to do something like this, and you're wondering if you're kind of being overly emotional, or you're letting some other part of yourself drive the decision you're making, I always ask them to just remember a time in their life where they lost their temper or they lost their head and they said something they deeply regret. I think everybody has a common experience there where you've had that happen. And when it does, I ask them, you know, what did you want from the person that you had hurt, right? You understood you'd be held accountable for what you said or did, right? But you didn't want to be treated that you were the worst person in the world. And I try to get people back to that space to try to make objective decisions based on what is actually in front of them as opposed to other circumstances. And, you know, for victims, I think, you know, the other way I think about it is I try to look at their perspective and really try to create for them a system that allows for listening, allows for them to be empowered. And I think for me, the most direct way to do that is to not let them get surprised, good or bad, up or down, whether this is going to go well or not the way anyone wants it to go. I try to tell them right off the bat, it would be disrespectful to you, if I didn't tell you the truth, or if I sold you a bill of goods that just was never going to happen. I'm very upfront with them. And sometimes that starts off with very rocky relationships, but I always tell them, I mean, it's something growing up in the household I did, it was, you know, you learn pretty quickly, you know, if people are not yelling at you anymore, they're done with you. But if they're willing to talk to you and express that emotion, that's coming from a place of they're interested in working through it. And I think for me, that's what I try to do, is just to create a space where I learn and learn and learn. And if you can get people talking, as much as it sometimes is hard to do, and you might lose patience, you got to get an understanding of what's really important to them. And by and large, you'll find out what's really important to them on both sides, defense and victim, and you're able to kind of get to that middle ground for them. And it's, I think those are the things that for me are the really enjoyable things, to get to the really complicated situations and find a solution. I've always found that to be something I love doing.
One of the things you said in our pre-interview, which I, I certainly appreciate and try to live up to is you said that you meet people in the space they are in and try not to judge them. And I like that because certainly for me at least, when I judge someone or certainly prejudge someone, I'm going to put certain blinders up and I'm not necessarily going to see that person as they are. That's number one, I got that. And the second thing I got from that was, I certainly hope I do that as this as well, is everyone has an inherent value, whatever they've done or not done. There's a certain inherent value there. And you to see them in the space they're in and not judge them is to affirm that value. Is that, to me, that seems like the fundamental of maybe I have answered my own question about you here, but to me, that's it. Does that sound right?
So right. I mean, I remember one time I had a case and I inherited it, you know, and everybody thought we had an uncooperative victim because the victim just wouldn't show up. Can't get her in. We can't get her in. We can't get her in for an interview. We can't get her in for a deposition. And I, you know, in the world I was in before in private practice, we don't have investigators, right? You get in your own car, you go find the witnesses yourself. So I went out there to go meet this woman and just say, hey, just give me my business card and let you know we really like to interview you. We've got this case coming up. We really need to talk to you. Defense needs to talk to you. And I met her and I learned that she was working like four jobs and she had no vehicle of her own to get to these things. So there were times in which she couldn't get from job to job while managing the children that she had. And because of that, because the responsibility to her child and her childcare and her kid's school was greater than getting there for this case, she was basically weighing all those things. She was like, sometimes I just didn't make the appointment. It wasn't that I wasn't interested. It was just, I can't make it today. So I would cancel them. And she would always call. And it was incredible to me because I was just kind of like, well, we've got a simple way around that. If you've got 15 minutes in between your jobs, you know, I'll come out to you with the phone or the computer and we'll do the interview that way. You don't need to come to us to do all that. And, you know, I find that to be the thing that most people don't really get into. It's that, you know, sometimes as lawyers, we get very much locked in our world of just, you know, they'll have to come down here to the courthouse or do something like that. And a lot of times we get frustrated with people. Prosecutors are, you know, right there with that, myself included sometimes. But, you know, it just kind of I always remember that one victim because she really taught me that, you know what, this is a portion of her life that she has to live with and she's got to weigh it in the realm of everything else, including wanting the right outcome for the case, but also wanting to move on with her life and take care of her children. And if I could find a way to kind of balance that out for her, I was more than happy to do it. And it had nothing to do with her being uncooperative.
Well, and I could see myself, maybe someone in your office or law enforcement, without getting that full story, thinking, here's someone who doesn't want to cooperate. We've done the whole investigation. Here's someone who doesn't care about society, whatever the thought storyline may be, when in fact, that's all made up and projected by our own fears and thoughts and desires, our own judgments, as you said, but meeting them in the space that they're in without judging gets you to the point where the reality is completely different.
Completely different. And I think you're 100% right. And I mean, we're all guilty of it. I mean, just who you are as a human being, you know, you make snap judgments to just try to get through your day. But it was eye-opening for me to see her in that space juggling all those things. And I still think about her sometimes when I'm like, man, I've got a busy day in front of me. And I'm like, well, there's someone out there that's got a busier day. Yeah. And is doing more with less. And that's just the most impressive thing to me. She's one of the people that I think about a lot in terms of just how strong you can be even when there's a lot going on.
I want to bring up one story about an interaction I had with you, and I wanted to ask you about it. You had charged a client that I wound up representing with a horrific act. And as part of that, part of the state's claim was that they had caused tremendous pain to other people. We were, and by the way, the penalty for it is forever in prison if you were successful in your prosecution. I remember we're sitting at counsel table. My client is there, and my client looks around, and you were at counsel table too because the way the courtroom was set up. And my client points to you and asks for your name. And without hesitation, you stood up and introduced yourself to the client. And I really, really appreciated that. And I'll share with you why I appreciate it in a sec, but I want to hear from you why. Why did you stand up, reach across, shake someone's hand, and introduce yourself to that person? And how do you deal with that going back perhaps to other people in your office, maybe witnesses where they're victims saying, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the way that I view the world, and again, being somebody that's maybe at times been in some rooms or some spaces that I'm sort of the outcast, there is a part of me as a human being that is sympathetic and empathizes with a charged person when they sit in a courtroom. It has to be a lonely feeling. I've represented people that have been defendants in cases, in serious cases, and I recall what that's like. And none of them obviously want to be there, and some of them, you know, should be held accountable and go through the process. But the bottom line is that I don't think that any part of who we are as lawyers, or especially prosecutors, you know, requires or should allow for us to dehumanize somebody that's on the other side, especially when we are there attempting to humanize someone else. We should expressly take the step of making sure that the person on the other side understands that we see them as a human being. We're here to hold them accountable, but that does not require us to go out and do something, do more harm or dehumanize them in any way.
And that was the answer I was going to give. What I appreciated more of is I knew you thought this person committed the crime. I knew that at the end of it, if the person were found guilty, you were going to seek forever. And yet you were able to still treat that person as a human being and affirm their humanity at the same time believing those things. And what I found remarkable about that is the inner strength that it would take to bypass, I would think would be, at least in my mind, the initial, like, almost an initial desire to dehumanize, right? Because certainly that makes it easier to potentially to prosecute someone, to take away their liberty. It certainly has to be easier for you, I would think, but yet that takes you down a path maybe you don't want to go.
You know, I was really fortunate. One of the things that I'm most proud of in my legal career is I worked on a case involving a man by the name of Reginald Griffin, and I got Reggie out of prison. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, how did Reggie end up in a circumstance he was where he was convicted of a crime he didn't commit? And, you know, when I started off, I was very much a hot-headed, you know, young lawyer wanting to argue that everybody on the other side was evil, right? They just wanted to punish this young black man who was poor and just another cog in the system. The reality, though, that I found was by and large, most of the people that were involved in that wrongful conviction were people who just wanted to try to get justice for a victim who had been killed. And they were blinded by pursuing something and not seeing my guy, Reggie, as someone who could be innocent. And they made mistakes. I don't think they were intentional mistakes, but they were mistakes. And being a prosecutor, something that I try to pride myself on is I don't ever want to make that mistake. I don't ever want to take for granted that it's possible that this person could be innocent, or it's possible that they're not the worst person in the world, irrespective of what I know they did. And that's why I'm here to prosecute them. And I try to keep that in mind and fully and regularly evaluate the information I'm receiving, even if it is a handshake or how they interact with their families. I'm always watching and trying to learn from that to make sure that I stay in a space where I can accept new information that might change the calculus. Because I feel like we should always be open to the idea that maybe something different has to happen.
The other thing you mentioned that I find fascinating is that you can't, maybe justice doesn't permit you to humanize and focus on the pain and suffering of the victim at the same time dehumanizing the very person that caused that pain. Meaning either you humanize both or you humanize neither of them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you have to humanize both. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, to really get to a point where you balance things out, you have to do it. And I always tell prosecutors when they struggle with this, and I struggle with this sometimes, it's because I see the harm to the victim so much closer to me because I get to talk to the victim, right? But I think the thing that more than anything else I tell people is this is not about me and what I think a good trial outcome would be or a good sentence would be. No one should celebrate when we get a guilty verdict, right? Because that's not going to bring back a life and it is not going to be a happy moment for the defendant or his family. But more than anything else, what I want is I want the victim to have a life after I'm in their life, have a life after we get a conviction or the case is over And the only way I can do that is get them in a space where I'm treating them as human beings. I'm fully and fairly and accurately understanding who they are, as opposed to just they're a piece of evidence. They're the testimony that points to the defendant, or they're the testimony at sentencing that gets me the higher number, but really figuring out what they need. And sometimes that is to take all the emotion that they have and allow that emotion to have a productive space in a courtroom so that they can then try to find a way in their new life, right? Outside of maybe losing a loved one. The people we deal with are remarkable in a lot of ways. I mean, I've had cases that have been, you know, what in our world are somewhat low level because they're nonviolent. And I've had property damage cases where I've had the victim offer the defendant a job. And I've had murder cases in which I've had moms, you know, tell the person who took their child's life, I'm going to work hard to try to forgive you. And that's a remarkable one. I don't know that I would have that strength if I were in that situation. But we see that. And I'm not alone as a prosecutor in reporting things like that here, because I've heard other prosecutors say it. And sometimes it's funny is the wrong word. It's interesting because you see the victim go through all the different stages of grief and anger, and they're very frustrated when they want maybe a higher number and we're agreeing or recommending something that may not be what they want. And then they get into a courtroom and they show just amazing strength and grace to the other person who has caused them this harm. And sometimes it's a forever harm. And I just think that those are just like those people to me are heroes. They're unbelievable human beings that are just walking the earth among us in terms of their strength.
And I know when we were talking in the pre-interview, you know, sometimes I was before a judge today and I was, you know, am I trying to get the judge to do something? But of course, I've been doing this long enough. I can't really get anybody to do anything. But what I can do, it sounds to me, I think what you do is you create a space or whatever you hope to happen. And so by you approaching everyone in there as a human being, affirming they're all humanity, regardless of what they did, and knowing that they have to suffer consequences. But by doing that, I wonder if that attitude creates a space for potentially for victims or their families in which healing can really happen. Because my guess is, and I know from my own clients, that in the cases where they have been wronged or they feel wrong, is that I certainly can buy into that and fan that flame. And that doesn't get them anywhere usually. And my guess is you could do the same thing and that they would leave maybe potentially worse off than when they came into your life.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think all of us as prosecutors that are part of the system, I mean, that's your deep hope is that, you know, they leave less harm than the day that you met them or starting in the process of healing. And that years later, they'll talk about, you know, the way that you treated them and the way that you made them feel as maybe one of the steps that they're taking towards kind of understanding how to operate in the new world that they're in. I would much rather have that be the case than them come back and say, you know, man, you know, we got him for 30 years, but it's never going to be the same. I'd much rather have them say, you know, I was really upset when we got 20 years, but I really appreciate the chance to speak to the court, to listen to everything, to understand why the circumstances were what they were, and that really helped me to get to a different space. I mean, look, sometimes 30 years is what it has to be, but I never try to do something that is going to cause more harm than I need to right the situation.
Then if we look at the world, I know we're talking about, you know, almost the world we want to be, but when we look today, at least at some interactions, there seems to be a tendency, and maybe this has always been this way, but to take sides, right? If the police are involved, then it's wrong or it's right. If the prosecutor's involved, it's wrong or it's right. There's this desire. And I'm wondering if you have an idea as to what it is within all of us, me included, that wants to take sides because that feels the inclination to, and then what we can look to potentially not fall victim to that desire.
I mean, I think it's easier to take sides. It's easier to shut off a part of your brain and take an us versus them approach in anything that you have. It's much harder when the issues are nuanced or they're gray and you have to really understand someone that maybe thinks differently than you or has done something to hurt you or make you angry. Like I get why taking a side feels good. But I just think that the only way to really live a full life is to try to see yourself in someone else and understand why it is that they're making the choices that they're making, or else I think you're going to run into some bitterness and some anger. And genuinely, I don't think those places in my day-to-day professional life, I don't think that that has any place in prosecution. I think the age of prosecutors doing it that way hopefully should be over. It certainly, I think in Gene's time in the office, that is not something that we would see as a fitting thing for a prosecutor to be. We don't appreciate that type of prosecutor. I think we always talk about, you know, you can be tough, but you need to be fair. The need to be fair is something that from our perspective is the most valuable trait in a prosecutor. We will celebrate both equally your ability to get convictions that are just with your ability to say, I can't file this case, even if I think that there's some evidence, or it's such a bad injury to the victim, or this guy may not be the best guy in the world. Your ability to measure it and say, the evidence is the evidence, I cannot file it, or the evidence is the evidence, a conviction is just. That's what we value more than anything else.
You know, one of the things that I know your office has put together and you've been intimately involved with is criminal mediation. And it seems as we talk about this concept of justice, this fairness, this impartiality, meeting people where they are in a non-judgmental fashion, that offers a solution for some cases.
Oh, it's an immense solution. I think that the more participation that we can have from victims in criminal cases, it's incredibly useful to us because it gives the victim not only a space within the prosecutor's office conference room or perhaps at the time that a defendant is sentenced to address the court, but really to get more of an active role so that they themselves can feel like they are really a part of the solution as opposed to someone that we just confer with when we are making recommendations to the court. So we found mediation to just be an incredible tool. I mean, we're grateful that, you know, Jackson County is a place that has a group of attorneys on the defense side and judges that are interested in it. I just, you know, our office runs stats pretty regularly. We resolved over 100 homicide cases. It's horrible to have a homicide case, but resolving them through pleas, we attribute to mediation, because at the time mediation started, I think there was a belief that, well, we would just mediate, you know, low level, non person to person crimes. We use them for homicides. We use them for high level crimes not because we don't want to try the case or we want lighter results. It's because we want the victims to have a stake in what these outcomes are. These are their lives, and we should create forums in which we get to a just solution with them being able to be more readily involved.
Well, and like we talked about, creating a space, and when I've been involved as a mediator and as a party to a mediation in criminal mediations, I found that the removing the formality of a courtroom where a victim has to address the court and not the defendant, where the defendant may be told, don't say anything to anybody, that when you take away that formality, you create that real space in which you're meeting people where they're at and they're allowed to express themselves. And there's something about that where I'm going to maybe use the word justice can happen.
I think that's 100% right. Because I think to victims, the ability to have a role in the outcome of something that happened to them has to feel, for them, at least appropriate might be the best word, but it has to feel good for them, because really the criminal justice system in so many ways sort of excludes victims, and it really in a lot of ways excludes defendants. It's really the lawyers using evidence to say up or down, innocent or guilty. And to have these main players actually playing a role that is going to help drive the solution about us figuring out what's fair here, I think is useful. And the ability sometimes of them to communicate with each other. We've had mediations that have ended with a portion of it being, well, you know, can the defendant tell us why this happened? And when you get an agreement and an outcome, that's something that we've seen take place, which is, again, it's an amazing moment that nothing was stopping us from doing those things before. But now I think we're more focused on considering really ways to engage the community and make sure that these people play a role in the circumstances that are now coming before a court.
I guess as we end the show, one of the things I wanted to ask you about that I've always wondered is, you know, I know you're getting phone calls at all times of the night. I know you go to murder scenes, crime scenes, and murder cases, and they don't happen on schedule. You are always making decisions that's going to make someone upset, presumably. And I wonder, what do you do personally to maintain a sense of balance, maybe equanimity, a sense of self, so that you can continue to be the same person that I've seen continuing on as you meet new stressors and new issues in your work?
I wish I had kind of a better answer. I think that, you know, it's weird to say, but, you know, I guess everybody in these situations says it's family. It's my spouse, my wife, Stephanie, who is literally my bedrock. And, you know, I've got great friends and mentors and people like Gene who are able to show me, you know, this is what toughness looks like. I've got parents who, you know, thank goodness are still living and a great support system and friends and family. But I oftentimes also think through the sacrifices that other people have made. I don't know why in my mind that's kind of where I go to thinking about it. And I know when we were talking about this interview, something that I just couldn't, it just kept coming back to the forefront of my mind. I mean, it's because I recently was just kind of doing some reading, some historical reading on Emmett Till's case. And so there's three prosecutors in Emmett Till's case. The lead prosecutor is a guy named Gerald Chapman. He very famously attempted to prosecute J.W. Milam, and Roy Bryant for the murder of Emmett Till. And he gave a closing statement. And in that closing statement, he used the words, "This case is dripping with the blood of Emmett Till," and actually formed the basis for the book written by Timothy Tyson, which is a fantastic book. All those prosecutors, Mr. Chatham and his two other colleagues, they ended up, I think the other one's name was Hamilton Caldwell and Robert Smith. They all ended up passing away within 7 years of that trial. These are three white prosecutors who went down into Mississippi in the heart of lots of racial tension. And the trial transcript in that case bears out how hard they worked and how much they wanted to get the right outcome. They weren't able to achieve it. But what was clear also was that Mamie Bradley, Emmett Till's mother, even at the time that the case was going, reported how impressed and how much she felt heard by these men and their efforts. Now, I don't ever want a prosecutor, none of my people that I'm good enough to get an opportunity to work with, to have a life in which their stressors just takes them and they're not able to kind of move on. I think it's something that prosecutors have to really work at. And we've tried different initiatives in terms of health and wellness. I think I'm someone at the forefront of it that needs to be better at it because I want to be here for the victims. I want to be here to make good decisions for defendants as well. But there really is no great answer to it. And that's really unfortunate because it's something that I think my industry, prosecutors, I mean, you see a lot with law enforcement. There's now a big push about wellness and mental health and emotional acuity and understanding those things. And I think the next iteration of that has to be prosecutors and defense counsel who see and deal with a lot of tough matters. There's not an easy conversation in our business. It's either we can't file it or someone's going to prison and it's because something bad happened before it. So I think we really have got to do a better job of understanding the impacts of these cases and the interactions we have on our lives so we can be better for it.
Well, and as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, certainly we have to affirm the humanity of the victim, of the defendant, but we have to start with affirming our own humanity. And I think maybe that's where the starting point is.
Nothing gets you into my office in trouble quicker than when I hear chirping back and forth between a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Like, yeah, nothing drives me more crazy than that. I just, for the life of me, I'm always like, you're above it. You have to be above it. You should not be getting into back and forth. You should not be nipping at each other. In an already stressful situation, you should not add any gasoline to it. Your job is to diffuse the situation and to be the one that measures it out, especially from our side, from the prosecution side. That's what you should be doing. So we have to also recognize, though, that's not easy and it comes with a cost and it's learned through working through your emotions, but it's absolutely something you have to do.
So Dion, one of the things I was thinking of when you were saying that was it starts with me affirming kind of my own humanity and realizing that I am human, that I certainly am subject to fault, but waking up every morning and realizing that I'm going to try to live up to whatever ideal I hold myself to.
I think that's a really well put. I mean, I think you have to understand your own limits. You said give yourself some grace. And I don't know a lot of times in my work, and I'm sure in yours, you're moving from thing to thing so quickly that you get frustrated if you don't accomplish the result you want. And then you have to move on to the next one really quickly. So I do think that that is really important for each of us to do, is to kind of look at ourselves and see, you know what, I may not have done this perfectly in this point, really reflect on it, take a moment and really debrief with yourself before you move on to the next moment, because of just the work we do, I think is so important that we need to be ready to be, I guess, present is the word that comes to mind for the next person that needs us.
Right. And because the failure to do that then would cause me to look at you maybe as a prosecutor, as something less than human, and you doing the same to me. And then we start moving away from where we want to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, if you can give some grace, whether it's yourself or to your opponent, I think that's something that is, that shows immense strength to me. It's easy to throw a punch. It's much harder to hold it back. So that's always something that I've really valued in people.
Dion, thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
No worries, man. Thanks so much for having me.
This is David Bell. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Insight Daily Radio. In her new book, Punished for Dreaming, Dr. Bettina Love argues forcefully that Ronald Reagan's presidency ushered in a war on black children, pathologizing and penalizing them in concert with the war on drugs. In her book, Dr. Love serves up a blistering account of four decades of educational reform through the lens of people who lived it. Punished for Dreaming lays bare the devastating effect on 25 black Americans caught in the intersection of economic gain and racist ideology. Then, with input from leading U.S. economists, Dr. Love offers a roadmap for repair, arguing for reparations with transformation for all children at its core. We spoke with her about this important book.
There's reparation committees popping up all over the country now. Detroit, Asheville, North Carolina, Evanston, Illinois. So we're starting to see on a national level, and I think California definitely can set the standard as we start to move forward. Because I think people truly understand that you can't just keep saying, we didn't do anything, we didn't do any harm. You have to take accountability for what you did. And if we're ever going to have a democracy that's deeply committed to justice, then you have to take accountability for harm. And reparations is a way to take accountability for harm and a way to transform structures so we don't keep harming people. Yes, it's about the compensation, but also how we end harm. And that's one thing I want to make sure when we talk about reparations, because we can give out a check. What about changing the structure so you don't do that harm again, so you don't have to hand out a check 50 years from now?
That's Dr. Bettina Love on her powerful new book, Punished for Dreaming, which has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.
What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, you can send an email inquiry or comment to kkfi.org/contact. This is Jeff reminding you Our outro music is Higher Ground from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with The Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day.